going to beat themselves, right?
What is it?
Next box.
This the one that we just broke.
Lixie, you should be filming that.
Sorry.
So now the rest of that suitcase.
The rest of that suitcase is my clothes and my dinner.
And the laundry, I think he will find.
Yeah. Right, presenting Daniel Pocock, he's been doing some really cool stuff with VoiceOver IP and Debian. He's going to tell us more about it. I was about to say he's got some freebies as well, but I guess he's just done that bit. So, yeah. Over to Daniel.
Okay, we'll just... I'm just going to log in and open up my presentation so you can follow along with what we're talking about today. Can everyone hear me okay off the back there? Can everyone see this okay? Okay, so there's a few things we're going to go through. We're going to start off with just a brief description of how people use their telephones. I mean, everyone here has probably got one or more telephones already and use them every day, and so we don't often think about the way that we actually use our phones. We just take them for granted. So we'll start by having a quick chat about the way people use their telephones. We'll then talk about how VoiceOver IP actually works. As opposed to other types of communication systems. We'll do a survey of some of the open source software that's available. There is a lot of open source VoIP software now, and probably missed some applications, and so I don't want some of those boxes being thrown right back at me if I've missed your project from my list. So this is just a short list of some applications that I've tried. I'll then give an overview of Reciprocate, which is a SIPS written in C++. We'll give an example application based on Reciprocate, and this is an application that you can download and study yourself later on. One of the purposes of this example is to show how you could link VoiceOver IP features into your existing application, whatever that application may be. We'll then show you one potential security issue in VoiceOver IP, and that is an issue that arises out of using this particular application. And then finally, we'll give some conclusions. So let's get underway. If people have questions along the way, or when you do see one of my mistakes, they are in there, they're put there deliberately, then maybe you'll qualify for another free piece of kit. So do feel free to jump in if you have something to say. Okay, so user expectations. People expect telecommunications to be very, very easy. Do you guys want to come in and move around and make yourselves comfortable? Okay. People expect telecommunications to be convenient. It's the same with software. They like to just download something and use it. If it doesn't work straight away, they'll just throw it out and try something else. The mobile phone is a classic example. People will use their mobile phone to make a phone call, even though it will cost them more money than the phone that's sitting on their desk, like that one. And the reason they do that is because they have an address book here and they've got all their friends and they can just browse through and choose the person they want to call. And this, these types of human behaviour are governing the way people communicate and the way they choose, you know, the equipment or the software that they will use to communicate. So if we want them to choose open source software, we have to bear these things in mind. People expect things to be free. There are boxes like these that we have here on sale at stores, particularly in the UK, they're selling a lot of them. And people are bringing them back when they discover that they have to register with the SIC provider and hand over their credit card number. Because the expectation they have now is they can take the box home and use it for free, and that they don't have to hand over any more money after they open the box. We've seen this with the inkjet printers, where the printers get very cheap. And the printer companies make their money when you buy the ink cartridges. So we're starting to see this with some voice over IP products. People expect them to be very cheap or free because they've seen companies giving away free phones. And then when they open the box, they're surprised when there's a further commitment to be made. This is an opportunity for open source because we can be the ones that are there waiting to greet them with an opportunity where they don't have to keep on opening up their wallet after they, you know, make their decision to try voice over IP. People don't like to miss a call. They like to be accessible just about everywhere. I mean, I've given some examples. 5 years ago, it was unusual to answer a telephone in a library or in a restaurant. But nowadays, you see these things happening all the time. So things have changed a lot in the last 5 years, and they will change a lot in the next 5 years. But once again, these are things we have to keep in mind. Technology like this telephone here has been made in this size. Phones that are this size that have SIP, that have Wi-Fi, they have internet addresses and everything all built into the phone. And so people can access their open, you know, VoIP networks from wherever they are, as long as they can find some sort of a wireless signal. Some of these phones have a combination of 3G, GSM and Wi-Fi all in the one phone. So there are many choices available to people so that wherever they are, they can try and get online. And we can help them to do that. And if we can help them to do that, to save money doing that, for instance, giving them a SIP number that they can use throughout Europe without roaming charges, then they will, you know, flock to these products. And some of this can be done by downloading software onto their existing phones. So that's the final point I've made there. So as developers, we need to look at how people are using their phones. We need to look at the everyday situations in how they're using their phones and think about that when we offer them products, because then we can see what they want and what they need. Now, how does voice over IP work? Typically in a phone call, you've got an audio stream in each direction. There's actually two audio streams. If you've got a stereo phone call, which is possible, then you'll have four audio streams, two in each direction. And you might also have one or more video streams. But let's just take the case of a typical phone call, which will have one audio stream in each direction. We use a connectionless protocol like UDP to carry the audio packets. However, UDP on its own doesn't do everything that we need. So the voice packets themselves containing the compressed audio are wrapped up in a RTP header. The RTP headers are able to help the system determine the time slot so that it can put the conversation back together in the right order. The RTP header also tells the system what method of compression has been used and other information that's important for putting the phone call back together. If you have stereo or other mechanisms for having more than one channel, then you can put information about that in the RTP. That is then encapsulated in the UDP. Can I just ask, is everyone here comfortable with what I'm talking about with UDP over the internet? It's a connectionless protocol. UDP packets go into the internet, they can be lost, VoiceOver IP doesn't care. In some situations, on a local area network, for instance, like a wire that's linking the phone to the computer here, there'll be virtually no packet loss. On a satellite link down to Africa, which is quite a common situation where VoiceOver IP is used, there will be maybe 5 or 10% packet loss when the line is full.
I've heard that stories about packet loss and network address translation problems can be improved by IPv6. The TDP packets will easier get through by IPv6 instead of IPv4. Is it true?
There are many possibilities for reducing packet loss, but the only point I want to make now is that packet loss is a fact of life. We can take various steps to eliminate it or to reduce it. When you put more phone calls down the wire, you know, that will increase the level of packet loss that you see. And so it is a fact of life in voice over IP communications. However, we choose to accept that is by accepting a little bit of packet loss and using compression systems that can deal with that, and we're able to actually save a lot of money and make a telecommunications system that gives people, you know, big savings, more flexibility and choices, and that's a worthwhile sacrifice. It's not like if you're making a transfer on your internet bank and you send a transmission to your bank to tell them how much money to transfer and where to send it to. If one of the digits goes missing in the account number, then you're going to have big problems. In a voice over IP communication, if someone loses 10 milliseconds of audio, and that's what a lost packet is, it's losing 10 milliseconds of audio, no one is going to notice and no one is going to come after you later and sue you for that lost packet. So the network is designed to accept this as a fact of life. The call setup, which is telling the network which number we want to dial, discovering whether the number is a number that exists or whether it's too short or too long, finding out if the other end is ringing, all of this is call setup. Or signalling, and this is done using a protocol called SIP, which is the Session Initiation Protocol. There are some other protocols in use. One is H323 and another one is MGCP. We're not going to consider those here, we're just going to consider SIP. The reason for that is it's easy to understand. It looks similar to HTTP, SMTP. It's implemented in most of the soft phones, which means that it's in a very strong position to compete with the likes of Skype and MSN, because people are duplicating SIP into their computers. Every time someone downloads a SIP application, that's more reach into the network. The typical audio streams that we transmit have an 8 kilohertz sample rate, so we're taking 8,000 audio samples a second. They're 16-bit samples. There's basically the same type of sampling as an ISDN network. The samples are then compressed, and we're going to look at the details of this on the next page. But the samples are, the important point is that they are compressed, so instead of having an 80-byte packet, you might only have a 10-byte packet, which is a big saving. I mean, that's a 8-to-1 compression ratio. And yet that is barely perceptible to the human ear. If you were to compress an image using that type of compression, you would be able to see the difference. But for audio, it's acceptable to do this. The frames of compressed audio are then embedded in the UDP, the RTP packets. You may put more than one frame of audio. So you might have 10 milliseconds, or you might have two lots of 10 milliseconds, a total of 20 milliseconds with one header. And that will save bandwidth. And finally, that's embedded in the UDP packet, which adds more headers. So once again, by fitting more milliseconds of audio into the packet, we can save on network capacity. The downside of that is if you lose that packet, then you lose more milliseconds of voice. So what we're going to consider now is some examples of this. You can see the first one at the very top is the G711. G711 simply compresses the 16-bit samples down to 8-bit samples, and then it expands those again when they're received at the other end. So although it's typically used with a 10 millisecond sample, it could be used with any variable, you know, multiple of one sample. So you have three samples per packet, which would not be very efficient. The result of that is that you have a 64 kilobit bit rate, but when you add on those RTP and UDP headers, you end up with an 80 kilobit bit rate. If you combine two frames, so two lots of 10 milliseconds, which is 20 milliseconds of audio in each packet, then the bit rate actually used will come down to 72 kilobits. You can see here how in a local area network, the difference between 72 and 80 kilobits is not going to bother most people. But if you're using ADSL and you're wanting to squeeze lots of phone calls into an ADSL line, let's say there's three people in your house and you all want to be able to use the telephone at the same time, if you multiply 80 times 3, that's 240 kilobits. And that is basically the upstream capacity of an ADSL line. Now if you remember that on an ADSL system you've got ATM cell sizes to worry about as well, in practice all of that data is not going to fit through and the phone call will suffer. So you'll have to choose a different method of compression. So as you look down the list, you find that there are other methods of compression that will fit a lot more phone calls through. If you do those same calculations with G729, you'll see that theoretically you can probably get about 7 phone calls through one ADSL line with 256 kilobits of upload capacity. So that gives you many more choices. So you can also be sending emails and things at the same time as doing a phone call. The G729 and G723, which are the second and third ones on my list, are both patented. The reason that I've put them here, though, is because many hardware devices, like the Linksys products, have support for these protocols. However, an open source application, like Asterisk, for instance, cannot encode or decode these signals without having the correct licenses. There are examples of how you could do this in source code on the web, which you can download and evaluate, but you should check whether you're allowed to compile and execute those. However, those compressed signals can still pass through your server if it's an open source product without you needing to license the product. So some SIP products don't take any interest in the compression of what's going through. They're just there to relay the signals. The last two codecs on the list, ILBC, which is actually one of the codecs used by Skype, which many people have heard of, and GSM, are both available to use in free software. Both of them give good compression. But the problem with these two is they're not as widely supported in the handsets. There are some handsets that only support the first three, the G711, G729, and the G723. So one of the problems you'll have when deploying voice over IP is looking at your handsets that you want to use and working out which codecs are going to be common between all of the handsets and the voice over IP provider and the open source product you want to use. Because unless all of the products support the same codec, you will run into problems either somewhere along the line the signal has to be converted and so you lose more signal, or things just won't work. You'll make a call and sometimes it will not connect because the system will just reject it because it won't find a matching codec. Or the worst case is that everything will default to the G711. And that will use up all of the bandwidth on your line if it's over a broadband line, and you won't be happy with the quality. So we've looked at the codecs and the transmission of the audio. Now let's look at SIP and how that will set up a call. So SIP is a protocol that's been produced by the IETF, as opposed to H323, which came from the ITU, which is the International Organization for the Phone Companies versus the International Organization for the Internet. So there's some fundamental differences between the two. SIP follows many of the conventions used in other internet protocols, and therefore we can leverage existing skills and existing code to deal with some parts of the SIP protocol. So it transmits information about the caller, so the caller ID, the codecs that the caller supports, and the callee, so the person you want to speak to. It uses headers similar to HTTP. And once again, the SIP packets are sent as UDP. So a HTTP connection, you establish a connection. When it's there, then you start sending the signals through. With SIP, you put together your headers, you put them in the packet, and you send it out over the wire. If it doesn't get an answer, you just send the packet again. You don't worry about a connection. You can do SIP over TCP in a connection-oriented manner. It's not as common as UDP. SIP defines some different entities. There's a user agent. There are two types of proxy. There's a stateless proxy and a stateful proxy. And there's a registration server. Each of these has a different purpose. The user agent is typically your telephone or maybe a PBX that can accept calls or that can initiate a call. Have I got a question here?
Yeah, you mentioned about TCP not being that widely used for VoIP. The magic CASA sort of get through firewall business is that it actually just defaults to TCP. The reason that it's so good at getting the reason that Skype is so good at getting through firewalls is that if it can't find a UDP that works, it just defaults to TCP. But what it does is it doesn't use grey sound. It doesn't drop when there's no voice. It just carries on transmitting packets at full bandwidth. So that means that the TCP connection is always, say, transmitting 8 kilobits per second or something, and that means that you don't get jitter quite as much. But that so I mean, people use it all the day, every day, and it actually doesn't sound that bad.
Yeah, there are a couple of differences there. With UDP and silence suppression, you can save bandwidth if you have many people on calls at the same time. So if you are sending TCP packets even while there's no audio, then you actually use more bandwidth than what's necessary. And the other thing is, if something doesn't get through and you have to send packets again with TCP, then that can cause issues when you're trying to get a lot of calls through. But I understand what you're saying with firewalls. It is a very effective way to get through a firewall, because many firewalls do allow TCP and not, and they don't provide as many choices for UDP. So with our SIP protocol, we've defined the different entities in a SIP network. So the user agent can initiate a phone call, whereas a proxy is not able to initiate a phone call. The proxy is only able to do things like checking the credentials of the person who initiated the call and then relaying the packet to the correct destination. The registration server keeps a database of all the locations of the users. So each user has a username which is similar to an email address. That's their SIP address. The registration server keeps a mapping of the SIP addresses to IP addresses. So if the user has a dynamic IP address, or if they have a Wi-Fi phone and they're constantly changing IP address, the registration server will always know where they are. So it's an important part of the SIP protocol. Some people build SIP networks without using registration. Everything is just done with DNS records. But if you have mobile users, then registration is important. So some applications, like Asterisk, Asterisk is not a proxy. Asterisk is a user agent and a registration server. Whereas something like SIP Express Router is a proxy and it is not a user agent. So it cannot initiate a call on its own, whereas Asterisk, being a user agent, can initiate a call to your handset. In this example here, which is taken directly from the RFC, you can see two user agents, one at the top labelled Bob, and the other one at the bottom labelled Carol. So the first step is Carol is switched on her device. You can see number one is it registers with the registrar. So the registrar will now know Carol's location. Later on, the registrar sends the information about Carol to the location service, which is some sort of a database, presumably. Maybe it will store this in a hash map or something. Now, at some point in the future, Bob wants to speak to Carol. So his user agent doesn't know her IP address. All it knows is the SIP address carol@chicago.com. So it sends this SIP address to the proxy. All the user agents presumably have the address of the proxy programmed into them. The proxy is then able to query the database, find the IP address, and forward that packet to Carol's user agent, which is step six. And then the conversation can continue. So Carol's user agent may send back a signal to say ringing or busy or whatever. We haven't gone that far in this diagram. So the URI is an important part of the SIP protocol.
One question about the previous slide. After the location service or the register confirms and select the IP address for Carol, for instance, the package flow from Carol IP address to Bob without the proxy. Or the proxy is involved somehow in package exchange after the registration took place.
So after step two?
After step five.
After step five, yes.
After the proxy has determined the IP address, what's happened next?
Okay, you've got two possibilities. The proxy may stay in the dialogue, which is important if NAT or firewalls are present. So all the SIP packets in either direction will go through that proxy. So every time either user needs to send a SIP packet to the other user, they will send it through the proxy. It is possible for the users to communicate directly with each other as well, but we frequently don't do that simply because we don't know when there will be a firewall present. But it is possible in the SIP protocol. And that is one of the reasons that SIP does have problems with firewalls, is because it does have all of these options for letting people communicate freely without a central server. And so when that happens, there's no constant state information for a NAT firewall to maintain. Anyhow, so each UDP message in the SIP network is a request or a response. So a request has a name such as invite, refer, buy, message, or register. So a request that starts off with register is intended to tell the registration server the location of the user. A message request is similar to sending an SMS or sending an instant messenger type message on your computer. An invite is used typically to create a session or possibly to change the parameters or the codecs while the session is in progress. The typical responses might be 180, which is ringing, 200, which is okay, so that's when the call gets answered, 486, which is busy, 503, might be that the person has run out of credit with their SIP provider, or that there's an error in the network. So the digest authentication used in SIP is also similar to the way that authentication is done in HTTP. So a challenge is sent, which is a 407 or a 401, and then the user agent has to send the packet again with the credentials as one of the headers. We can see a sample here. The packet, these are two different packets. The packet at the top is a request, and the second packet is a response. The request is an invite, so this is to set up a call. If you look at the to header, it's to Bob. And if you look at the from header, it's from Alice. So this tells us who is calling who. You've also got, after the invite, you've got the request URI. So this may have been rewritten by a proxy as the packet went through the network. So when a proxy looks at this packet, it won't look at the to URI, it will actually look at the request URI in the first line. At some stage later, Bob's phone has responded and sent OK, which means that Bob has probably picked up the phone, unless his phone was in auto-answer mode. You notice that both packets have a common call ID, and there are also tags appended to the to header and the from header. These three items, the to tag, the from tag, and the call ID, are used to uniquely identify that dialogue, which is a dialogue being, you know, the phone call from the moment it was dialed to the moment it finishes. There might be many packets sent in between, and they are identified as a single dialogue. So the next thing that we're going to look at is just a survey of some of the open source software that's out there. So if there are any mistakes here or if there are any omissions here, then I apologise for that, because I've tried many of these but not all of them. And the first thing you'll see is several PBXs and proxies. Some of these behave as a proxy, others behave as a user agent. So if we look at Asterisk, for instance, which is a very popular product, Asterisk is popular because it has a lot of features. And the way it implements those features is by behaving as a user agent. So that, to some extent, limits the scalability of the product. But for a small organisation, the promise of all those features, such as voicemail, call queues, things which are all made very easy by a user agent, are very appealing, and they'd be very expensive elsewhere. For a large organisation, something like SIP Express Router, which is just abbreviated as SER, provides a lot more scalability. It provides a lot more scalability. You can have millions of users potentially connected with a product like that, because it, all it does is it relays the SIP packets. It never handles the RTP packets. A user agent like Asterisk will usually handle the RTP packets. It can drop itself out of doing that, but often it will choose to get involved if, for instance, you want to record calls, or if you're, if the two endpoints don't have the same codec, or if there are firewalls in the way. The next thing you've got on the list are various soft phones. Many of these products you can download, but some of them will link in with other applications like your web browser, so you can click and dial someone else. And finally, we've got some various SIP libraries that are available. I've given you a few examples in C and C++. There are also some Java implementations of SIP.
Sorry, you were saying Asterisk can stay involved in the call and handle the RTP streams. How is it not a proxy if that's the case? It sounds very much like it's acting like proxy, unless I'm kind of missing the point.
Okay. When Asterisk is involved in a call, you can have two SIP dialogues. So remember we looked before at the definition of a dialogue?
Yeah.
When you go through a proxy, there will be a single dialogue between the user agents at two ends. However, when you use Asterisk, there are two dialogues. Each user agent has engaged in a dialogue with Asterisk, and then Asterisk internally decides how to link them together. So the two user agents may be completely unaware of where the other user agent is. Does that make sense? Would you like me to draw a diagram, a little whiteboard?
That's cool.
I'm just worried about my electricity. I'm not sure I've plugged in here.
A quick note, the guy just came in and said we have to clear this place out in 10 minutes. It's not our choice.
Okay. Lock
the doors.
That's alright, because my battery was only going to give me... battery was only going to give me 2 minutes.
And then...
Anyhow, we're going to look at Reciprocate, which is a specific implementation of Zip. Reciprocate is very extensive. It is an open source project focused purely on implementing SIP. So something like Asterisk is trying to implement many protocols and features in an application. Reciprocate, on the other hand, the developers are just implementing SIP. So it does that very, very well. So it's very useful to be able to use that as a component in other applications. It's divided up into different components. RUtil is just a set of utility classes for threads or strings in the rest of the application. The stack, which is the second component, handles individual SIP messages. It doesn't know about the dialogue from end to end. It just handles the SIP messages, passing the headers, helping to process the authentication strings. One of the useful features of the stack is that it doesn't pass all of the headers of every message that's received. It only passes them as they're needed. So it's a lazy parser. It's very efficient. You've got the Dialogue Usage Manager, which is abbreviated DUM, and that manages the dialogues from end to end.
Does it support additional codecs? I got a new codec that supports MP3 streaming quality.
No, because it's only the SIP stack, it only does the signaling. So it doesn't care about the codecs. It does have a representation of the SDP. SDP is used to describe the codecs that will be used in a call. And so you can create an SDP to talk about any codec that you will use. But you'll need to get another codec, such as another open source library that provides the codec functions that you want, and also the RTP functions. So your typical classes in the Dialogue Usage Manager are the Dialogue Usage Manager class itself. So normally you'll have one instance of that class in an application. And the Invite Session Handler. Invite Session Handler is an interface. It's so we need to provide an implementation of that in our application. That implementation class will then be notified when events occur in the SIP dialog. So using Dialogue Usage Manager, we create a subclass of Invite Session Handler. If we want to do authentication, we need to create a subclass of Server Auth Manager. Our subclass may then do Radius lookups or MySQL lookups or whatever we require. We then create an instance of SIP Stack and Dialogue Usage Manager. On the SIP Stack, we'll set things like the port number that we want to use. We'll specify whether we want SSL, UDP, TCP, all the different choices. And then the application just goes into a loop, giving the process method of each of those objects the chance to do the work for us. The Dialogue Usage Manager, when we call process, which we call over and over again, somewhere inside that method, it will make a call back to us, telling us that something has happened. So typically, I would write an object called my Invite Session Handler that would receive those callbacks. And these are some examples of some of those. Can everyone see that okay? So I realise some of the fonts are a bit small. So a typical event is on new session, which is the second from the bottom. So when you start a new session, either because a session is coming in, so someone's called you, or because you've initiated a call, then on new session will be called. And you can then save details about that session for use later. On connected, is when the session has actually connected, either because we've answered or because the other party has answered. Either way, on connected would be called. Finally, on terminated would be called when the session is complete. So we always know when a session has gone away. When I say on new session, I'm referring to a dialogue that has started. This is how the example application is put together. I think some of you have probably seen the example. We had it running at the Debian stand over in the main hallway. So if we don't get through all of this now, then it will be running there again tomorrow. The application is a click-to-dial application. It's built in two parts. There's the SIP dial component, which you can see, and there's also lib SIP dial. The idea is that just by putting a few lines of code into your application and linking with lib SIP dial, then you can have click-to-dial features in your application. So you might have a button that people can click when they want to ask you questions about your program. And they click the button and it dials your telephone. Maybe you do not want this. maybe it will dial someone that you don't like. It depends on how many people are downloading your application. Anyhow, there's many ways that we can send instructions to the dialer. We can link the application, if it's a C application or a C++ application, and then we can put that code into the application. We can use something like gconf, which is what Mozilla and Firefox use. So what we do is we put an entry in the gconf database to say that a SIP URI or a tel URI is handled by the SIP dial application. An application like Firefox, when it sees that URI, will then send the call to the SIP dial application. So the SIP dial application has been tested with the Linksys, the Cisco and the Polycom phones. The Linksys phone obviously being less expensive than the other two. It can work with other phones like Budgetone, but they would all provide the auto answer feature. So what we'll do is we'll give a quick demonstration of this.
One question, where is the codec and the library actually compress and decompress the data fit in this picture? Basically, if I instantiate the dialog manager and stuff like that, I will be notified when a session starts. And then data will start to flow. What will happen then?
Okay, reciprocate is purely signaling. Okay, all of the RTP, so the media streams, have to be handled by other code in your application. Now, there are other open source implementations of RTP, there are open source implementations of the codecs, so you would get each of those different libraries and link them all into your application.
So basically on them we use separate for that.
Yeah, I mean in one recent project I used CCRTP, and that was very effective. So reciprocate would set up the call, and then it would start a CCRTP object which would create a thread, and that other thread would send the media stream. Have we got, what we've got here, let's just have a look at the HTML source view. You can see the tel URI. Yeah. So this is similar to a HTTP, but we've got a tel colon and a number. So when someone clicks that link, then Mozilla calls the application, the SIP dial application. And that will send...
Congratulations. Yeah. You have
successfully installed... So you can see that the phone was sent a signal telling it to dial that number. This phone supports auto-answer, so when the signal comes in, it's able to go off the hook and then dial the number we want. If a phone doesn't support auto-answer, then it won't be that smooth. So that's basically the the demonstration. There will be an example of doing this with open groupware, running at the Debian stand and also at the open groupware stand. So you can actually have tell URIs for all of your contacts in your phone book, and you can click them and dial them, which gives people the convenience that they have with their mobile phones.
I had a question, a comment on your presentation, and especially on patents. Last week, the Supreme Court in the US is examining a conflict between Microsoft and AT&T for Microsoft shipping a NetMeeting. And in fact, I dig a bit into the case, and they are fighting for distribution of an audio codec, which was developed by AT&T and which was patented. And I think it was in the list, I think it was G. I'm not sure because I've not seen the patent numbers, but I'm pretty sure it's in the list. And the interesting thing is that the Supreme Court has never said that software was patentable in the US, and they most of the judges are convinced that it's not the case, and that probably in the near future it's possible that they can waive up the patent that are on those codecs. So one thing you could do is try to lobby the Supreme Court and ask for some arguments to raise the issue that the codec is software and is, should not be patentable under Rule 101 in the US.
This is a big issue, and if you have a link or something about this, please send it to me because I will put this on my G729 website. I mean, as some of you have probably discovered, I distribute a source code implementation of the patented technology. So I'm not running that code on my laptop, and I'm not running it in my network. But the source code is there for you to study. And to work on it. While it is free for you to study, and there are mirrors out there, you're welcome to look on my website. Anyhow, there's one security issue I was going to go over, but I realise we're really short of time now. If you've seen the example we've just done, just imagine if you sent one of those signals across the network in your office to your boss's phone, telling his phone to dial an 0900 number while he's in the middle of an important meeting with his boss. Okay. Not only that, but he will actually be charged for that. It will come up on the phone bill that it came from his extension. So when we deploy voice over IP, we do have to take some care for security to look at how it's used, because by default, some products are not secure, but they can be configured to work in a secure way. So finally, some conclusions. Many applications will integrate SIP features thanks to stacks like Reciprocate. So many applications will add SIP dialing to their list of features. Traditional telecommunications is going to lose market share, and that's going to mean an opportunity for open source software to fill that gap and to compete with products like Skype and MSN. And this is the ideal time for open source and open standards to establish themselves and to make open source and open standards the default way of doing telecommunications rather than a product that has a blue screen of death when you're in the middle of a phone call. So thank you very much for coming today. These are some websites where you can find some more information. And now we've just got to get rid of the rest of these products.